or with a very poor word, nature, which you should try to avoid in dealing with philosophy or other problems. It's a misleading word today. These two worlds do not coincide. The world of the United States in which you live is much smaller than the universe of all the suns and all the stars. And the order which the United States proclaim to you by its laws and manners and mores and your parents and your teachers and the order of the universe are absolutely contradictory. This society in which you live is a soft society and assumes that no wrong can be done by students. They have always to be pardoned. There's an eternal mercy called momitis. And in nature, everything is hard. Every cause has an effect. It's absolutely merciless. Now, what shall we make of a nature that is merciless, gentlemen, and of a society which even calls the most terrible murderer still somebody who has to be pardoned and coddled or at least fed for a lifetime in a prison because you hate capital punishment? Absolutely contradictory. In the animal kingdom, obviously, there is the survival of the fittest and has been acclaimed as a tremendous truth. And you yourself behave as though you can be a misfit totally and you have a right to live. This is the eternal contradiction of philosophy, gentlemen. And there can be no day of human history where this trouble is not going to arise. Because even if we have the whole globe organized, there is still Mars, and there are still the suns, and there is still the universe outside, the stratosphere. And never, never shall this dilemma end, gentlemen. The human mind is placed between two sources of information which mutually exclude each other in their conclusions. And as long as you do not see that physics and ethos are at opposite ends, you cannot understand logos. Because logos is an attempt to see the same meaning, the same truth, the same revelation, the same wisdom at work in the stars and in the human heart. Now, the stars collide. You must not collide on the highway. So here is collision, God's law, or divine law, or natural law. Call it as you like, you see. And here in nature, in society, there is the law of no collision. Hitler, coming falling under the spell of natural law, said, let's have all the collisions. I collect collisions, because that's natural law. Then is an animal. Concentration camps, forced labor camps, collision. Give you an American example. Yesterday, who died yesterday? Saw it in the papers? Who died? Very interesting man. Who died? Gentlemen, that's unethical. You are just nature boys. Nature doesn't care for death, you see. Ethics do. I'm sorry. Mr. Weyerhaeuser died. Who is Mr. Weyerhaeuser? Who is it? Yeah? What did you say? Nobody knows who Mr. Weyerhaeuser is?
He was the heir to a large timber fortune in a family out on the west coast of Oregon.
So, he died in Tacoma, Washington. Washington is even more his domain. Oregon and Washington. Yes. Well, Mr. Weyerhaeuser, gentlemen, is of a family who plundered the wood reserves, forest reserves of the United States in the first generation so shamelessly that Congress published such a volume against them in 1913. Now they are the great philanthropists of America, and they have 9,000 tree farms. And in 1941, the man who died yesterday at the age of 57 founded the first tree farm. So it took him 29 years to make amends for the shock he had given the forests of this country, the resources of this country. And he today is, of course, as you love all these robber barons so deeply, he is now today is worshipped and revered and, of course, heads the Republican Party. It's a joke, gentlemen, because for philosophers, gentlemen, the question is, why couldn't Mr. Weyerhaeuser operate in the same way in 1913? This is a eternal philosophical question with regard between ethics and physics, you see. In physics, no mercy. But if you have a country to live in, gentlemen, if you have a gift outright, as Mr. Frost has put it about the American soil and the American, you have heard his poem, haven't you? Indeed, our gift outright. Who knows the poem? Well, that's, gentlemen, that's the Magna Carta of America. You better go and read it. I think it's preposterous that there is anyone in this classroom who has not read it or heard it. Be ashamed. How can you be Americans and not know this poem, gentlemen, which says everything about your relation to your own land? He should send back his two doctorates of philosophy. You don't deserve him as your honorary doctor. It is not an honor to be the honorary doctor of Dartmouth, but it is an honor for Dartmouth if some people accept the degree. Because for your intellectual merits, you see, gentlemen, this is not a distinction to belong to your group. I'm serious, gentlemen. This is incredible that Robert Frost can live here on this campus, and here you are seniors and juniors, and you don't know this poem, A Gift Outright, which made him famous all over America. The problem of American soil is a very serious one. As you know, it's shrinking. And we have not only the dust storm problem in Texas, but the whole problem of the future of mankind on this little soil is still unsolved. Obviously, with the humanity increasing as it does, we probably have to go into the deep sea to be fed, and very soon. And the Weyerhaeusers, gentlemen, put a philosophical problem. Why? Physics, gentlemen, if it is just an object of men's exploitation, it is under mercilessness, under the law of just struggle, you see, survival of the fittest, exploitation. If you carry that to the extreme, survival is absolutely right. But obviously, appropriation, gentlemen, that is the appropriation of a part of the universe, entails an obligation to find out the will of its creator, the destiny of this soil. And this soil has to be reproduced. It has to be, as we call it today in this country, conserved. Conservation. Conservation is a very poor word, you know. But in this country, you have no better word. But you must always know the real problem is that man is the mouthpiece of all the other creatures, and that he has to deal with bees and apples in their own manner. You cannot go from Chicago to Africa and kill all the elephants and the tigers off as they do now. It should be immediately forbidden. It's just an orgy today. Oh, I have met these millionaires. I was in Egypt studying, and there they came. I have told you, I think, the story. Flying in, just shooting, and the lady sitting in an armored car looking at her great husband. And that's done here. Oh, now, you do it now because you can't do it anymore in this country where we have killed the moose and the wild pigeon and everybody else. I say everybody else, gentlemen, because you see what an ethical problem it is. At what point, at which point, gentlemen, does the sun and the moon and the elephant and the trees become our own brothers and sisters? When do you have to call them he, and when are we allowed to call them it? That's a great problem. Your car is she, the ship is she, because you know that your life depends on them. So you couldn't say it of your car, and you couldn't say it of the British couldn't on their island call it it. That's the reason why both are she. Now, gentlemen, as long as in this country we cannot speak of the forest as he's and she's, as we speak in poetry today of the sun and the moon, you haven't done wrong, right, by this physics, because you have not taken it across the boundary of ethics into your city of men. It hasn't become a living part of your humanity. And that's the whole trouble with this country, that the pioneering days allowed men to squeeze a farm dry like a parchment, throw it away and go to the next farm. They said so. I knew a farmer who said, I've squeezed 25 farms dry in my life, and he wasn't sent to prison. In any other country, the men couldn't be a citizen. Now, Mr. Weyerhaeuser was exactly this kind. It took him 29 years after the report of the Congress to recover his senses, and in 1941 he started the first tree farm. Gentlemen, what's a tree farm? Something is a poor word for a good thing. We call it forest in Europe. It's a forest. And any forest in Europe is something that has to last 1,000 years. Gentlemen, the percentage of woodland in Germany and Austria has remained the same until the French marched in 45 and took their revenge and killed the Black Forest. That was the most barbarous invasion of 1,000 years. Neither the 30-year war, nor the peasant war, nor any other 7-year war, no war has ever killed the woods. Only when the French were permitted by the Americans to pose as victors did they murder the Black Forest. And the men in charge of the forest flew out in this despair, committed suicide, and the French were so deeply menaced by this suicide that the men's deaths could not be announced in the papers in 47. That they forbade even to publicize that the men had killed themselves, because it was, of course, a demonstration. They behaved like Mr. Kadar behaves in Hungary. So because the forest is a living thing in Europe, you know there are many songs to the forest, and very true feeling that a tree has as much a right to be reproduced as a family. And in 1150, gentlemen, the percentage of woodland in Central Europe was 27%. And in 1945, it was still 27%. If you think of this, gentlemen, you know that physics and ethics are in constant cahoots, in constant conspiracy. That it is a deep problem, you see, to know that physics poses an ethical problem, just as you and I pose a physical problem. We have to eat, so we are part of physics. And the earth has to be respected, so it's part of ethics. And therefore, the lines are constantly shifting between ethics and physics, and perhaps I have now made some step forward to make you understand that philosophy is not a luxury and not an invention of a department, but that every one generation is settled with this relationship between law, ethics, and physics. It has to be said what the relation is, you see. When do you call a tree it, and when you do call a tree? That's the problem. And every generation has to put it differently. If you have an abundance of trees and a few people, you make burn all the trees as a clearing, as you did in 200 years ago here. No, you see, very understandable, but it can't last. Now we have, you see, many people and fewer trees, and the thing becomes quite serious. The logos, then, gentlemen, is the apportioning of ethics and ethos and physics to reality. And to prove to you, gentlemen, that this is something you yourself are immersed in, let me now give you an example of the moment, of the present day. A naturalist, gentlemen, deals with, let's take the simple example, birds, curves, waves, and he describes them so that anybody can see them. Now, the historian, now the ethicist, deals with the Battle of the Bulge. Has anybody heard of the Battle of the Bulge? Who has? Only a fraction. Wait. Gentlemen, when I and you deal with the Battle of the Bulge, which was fought at Christmas time 1944 and into the January, which was a battle, the last stand Hitler took against the Americans, where the famous Metz was set. At where? Okay. Bastogne, sure. Now we have here a very interesting problem. The high point was probably the resistance of the general in Bastogne. But the battle is rightly called the Battle of the Bulge. What's the difference, gentlemen, between bulges in physics and the Battle of the Bulge? Can anybody tell me the situation of the logos with regard to a physical event, that something bulges, like a dress, anti-historical event that something is called the Battle of the Bulge. What's the difference? If you approach it in a spirit of investigation, what is proposed to you? What do you have in front of you when you look at the Bulge and when you hear of the Battle of the Bulge? What's the difference? If you can understand this, you come nearer to understanding another aspect of this eternal battle between ethics and physics. And it must be my attempt to make you see that all history of philosophy today, all the books, the popular books of philosophy, are so nonsensical, so valueless. They give you anecdotes, but they do not tell you that there is in every year of the Lord the same question necessarily asked. You see, always the same. Philosophy has one theme and nothing else. And you don't believe this. You think philosophers are Brown study men who think of something. They don't think of something. They think of the one dilemma in which every son and daughter of man is immersed. That is, you have to distribute your loyalties between Burgess, gentlemen, and battles of Burgess. Why? I'll give it to you because you won't find it. If you speak of the Battle of Waterloo, the historian, the philosopher, the thinker, the man who comes later, it already has a name. And as this name, it shook the room after. The Battle of Waterloo made the fortune of the Rothschild bankers. It made the English put the monument of Wellington in front of their stock exchange. It brought about the restoration of the Bourbons, and therefore every Frenchman to this day who is a leftist trembles with respect to the name of the Battle of Waterloo. That is, gentlemen, historical, ethical, political events, events in the society of men, express their reality, their significance by names which meet with mixed feelings, which create tremendous emotions and tremendous actions. If you name Kossuth, the name of Kossuth in Hungary at this moment, it inflames the Workers' Council against the Russians. And it therefore is a reality in society, which when you talk to the Niagara Falls about Kossuth, has no corresponding response. Nature, gentlemen, cannot be spoken to. Human beings, however, are ruled by words, by names. I can arouse your feelings by any wicked name I give you or give something you love. I cannot call your father SOB without your coming out and say, take this back, I'll hit you hard, right you are. Names, gentlemen, are that what moves human beings. Nothing else. Nothing else, gentlemen. You cannot get any soldier to go to war if you cannot say to him, go to war. That's why you are so silly when you say a war is murder. I hear people often confuse these things. Or when the Puritans, not the Puritans, but the diseased Puritans, thought that marriage was obscene because you had to get children. Gentlemen, what you call it, that's what it is. Blood and marriage are angelic, are heavenly power. Prostitution is something quite different. It has a different name. And rightly so, because it is something different, it swings in a different context. I know that many marriages today are not better than prostitution, and there are very many honorable harlots, but the main thing is that even though the names themselves, gentlemen, carry weight. Perhaps you take this down, gentlemen. The Battle of the Bulge carries weight with you and me. It moves us to action. Because the name itself is a part of the event. An event has only happened after it has been called so received its name. The Battle of Waterloo was only the Battle of Waterloo after the English had decided to call it that way. Blücher tried to call it Belle Alliance, the Good Alliance, and it didn't work. There was another name proposed, you see. It didn't enter history. The French and the English have decided to call it the Battle of Waterloo. In German textbooks, you still read the name Belle Alliance. And for the Prussians, who didn't enter the spirit of the French Revolution at all, it made not much difference. The downfall of Napoleon had no immediately political, you see, democratic repercussions. The Battle of the Bulge, gentlemen, cost me some American friends. We were seated at New Year's party together while these news came in, and this was the one time that the Americans really trembled. It was a shock. It was unexpected. It was a setback after they already had felt that everything was over. We all, of course, were terribly grieved, but my friends, who were dear friends for by that time 10 years, broke with me inside because they said, this is a German. Well, who knows? He's one of these wicked peoples. They ascribed to me, so to speak, the Battle of the Bulge. Anything could happen with me because I came from this cursed country which offered a defeat to these victorious American armies. It was quite a shock to me, I can assure you. There we were, good friends, you see, in a close company, in a private home, and you just felt that they had to take it out on somebody. So it was me. That's what a Battle of the Bulge does. In the world of ethos, gentlemen, we are ruled by names. You know very well the difference between Negro, colored people, and nigger. It's a difference, and it has different consequences, which word you use. Very great distinctions, as a matter of fact. So it is with WASP, and it is with Christ Killer, and it is all these nice words which the American language harbors. And it can't be helped, gentlemen, because we know each other by names. You give me the name professor, I give you the name student, you see, and that gives us each other status. And we cannot be natural with each other, you see. We have to be ethical. And it's Rousseau's and Thoreau's error that he thought men can be natural. I have tried to tell you that ethos is always older than nature. Nature is the common impression of second thought on all of us. But society is my role with regard to other people's roles. It's reciprocal. Nature is a second-rate experience. Nobody can experience the space except with others together. All nature, that is all mere space outside, can only be observed if you are firmly grafted in the common sense and the common life of a society. No individual, no baby, can observe nature because it is fearful until his mother has said, you can look out of the window, I'm with you, I'm protecting you. Any physicist, you see, has a fire department and has you and me, the taxpayer, before him, before he can be delegated to the front of nature looking out for us into space. If you can once see this, gentlemen, space we all have in common, but your lifetime you have for yourself. And therefore, your lifetime has to be reaffirmed by the name given you. The President of the United States is now president for 4 years. He is it only because we say so, you see? The men in Haiti today, as you know, resigned as president of Haiti on December 6th, and now he calls himself just nothing. Therefore, the law has been broken. Have you seen it in the paper? A funny man. He resigned as president because his term was up. He didn't allow a re-election, a second election. He took command of the armed forces, and now he is a nameless somebody, and everybody has a right to declare that there is no law in Haiti. And he didn't know this idiot. He lives in probably went to an American prep school, where nature and ethos are confused. All of you gentlemen are sick because you don't know this distinction. All of you think that life is experienced as in the same way in society and in nature. In nature, you never experience life. You only experience death. You only experience things. What you call experience, gentlemen, is not what you think it is. In society, we experience how people call us. That's what you experience, you see. And how they expect you to call them. That's the real experience in society. For example, if you have the experience of your first love, you understand that your girl expects to be called by a name she has never heard before. If you can't invent a name for this girl, she'll never love you, right? Any young love can demand that the persons involved are called with a name never used before on them. That's what makes the poet. That's why poetry is necessary in love, because you go to the poet and borrow some of his epithets so that your girl may give you name. Better be poetic. But this sentiment is experience. And an experience which you cannot make in nature. You cannot make an experience in nature because you can, of this kind, because you cannot speak to nature. Nature can operate on your five senses, but it doesn't make sense. But if your girl suddenly calls you Johnny and is reconciled to your advances, you have made a tremendous experience. Somebody spoke to you who did not speak to you before. That's the difference. And that is experience. All the words you use, life and experience, you abuse, gentlemen, because you have lost the wall between nature and society. And that is the deepest reason, gentlemen, why Marx came into being against the liberals. In this country, as you know, liberals today are communists. But gentlemen, there's a wall between liberal thinking and communist thinking. And what is the wall? The wall is that Marx said it's all society. It's how we call each other, how we speak to each other, how we treat each other, reciprocity. And all the liberals, every American philosopher, statesman, and thinker tries to deny that we are anything but natural beings. And there is no understanding, therefore, on the real Marxian issue today in this country. Marx has nothing to do with what the Russians do. That's politics. Marx was a very profound thinker who saw that Rousseau and Thoreau and Franklin had abolished the wall of the eternal dilemma, of the double household in which we live. You live in a family of human beings who call each other by names, by the right or the wrong names. And you live in a natural, you see, world outside, but only if you had it together, if the solidarity. Society is ruled, gentlemen, by solidarity despite every man's own time. Nature is ruled by distinction despite the unity of space. Will you take this down? Society is ruled by solidarity despite the distinction of every member's time, or lifetime, you can say, or time span, or your time. And nature is ruled by the distinction of everything, by the distinction of everything, despite the unity of space. Well, sir, I wish you would write this down too. Why do you refuse? I shall treat you as a piece of nature from now on. Society lives by solidarity despite the distinction of every man's own time. And space lives by the distinction of everything despite the unity of its space. If I speak to you, gentlemen, I have declared my solidarity. I can only speak to people whom I grant life and who grant me life. Whenever you speak to a person, he's pardoned. There was a great law in the kingdom of Spain when the king, or the Roman emperor too, when a man would, with a judge or the king or the emperor or the dictator, speaks to a man who is condemned to die, the man is pardoned. Because the sanctity of the society demands that when the living word reaches one of the members, you see, the highest power, the supreme power, he thereby has received it. In the old times, gentlemen, in any tribe, in any Indian tribe, when the father of the family received the child and gave it his name, the child could no longer be exposed and his life couldn't be destroyed. By the acceptance of this of the personality of this child, by giving it its own name, the child only made the threshold between nature and society. That is, the ancient citizen knew very well that it is only the word spoken to somebody who takes him across from physics to ether. We do this, and we don't have to do it. Hitler snuffed out, as you know, all the 6 million Jews by giving them a number. And at the end, they had even not their own name. And at that very moment, he felt strong enough to find helpers to extinguish them. As long as they had their name, I think many of his hangmen would have shuddered by his lawlessness. But first, he flipped them outside society on the dung heap of nature. And once you deprive a person of his name, and you don't even know that he has a name, he's just a number, you can easily reconcile your conscience, you see, and say, oh, it's for the good of the country that these people are wiped out like lice. And that's what he actually did. He said in the beginning, I shall weed them out like grass, like weeds. And I shall teach people to look into them, the character of weeds. So, gentlemen, ethics and physics are a political problem. Philosophers are always in politics. Always in politics. At this moment, gentlemen, this country is without any thought, without any mind. I mean, I think the all-time low, Mr. Herbert Hoover Jr., the man panic-stricken, the shit in his pants. And that's representing us to the outside world. I mean, the all-time low in foreign politics has been reached in this country. Fortunately, the man is dismissed. Even they find out in Washington. And it's a great scandal, gentlemen. But foreign policy, now we cater to Mr. Nehru's policy, because policy has to be. Mr. Nehru has now to tell the American public what's ethics and what's physics. If you read carefully how we cling to this Asian-African bloc, why? Because everybody has now European thought can't be listened to. Europeans in America, like myself, can't be listened to. But we can listen to this idiot, Mr. Nehru. If you read his Universal History, it's the stupidest book that has ever been written. But it is. It's available in Tauchnitz for 80 cents. There has never been anything so miraculously stupid. But he's a great wise man. Because this country has no philosophy, it has declined to listen to philosophers, so it must listen to any witch sorcerer from the outside. Once it was a Chinese who was beloved, now Mrs., what was her name? Mrs. Chiang Kai-shek, yes. And you have had a hard time to remember that, but I assure you, in my time, even my horse got his name from her. Because my young friend of ours was such an enthusiast, you see, and her family gave Mrs. Chiang Kai-shek $1 million. And so she got the right also to name my horse, now it has a Chinese name. Only to show you that every 10 years some other influence in this country of some philosophical, allegedly philosophical nature is at work. And I just come from Boston and I have a dear friend there. She was always progressive, she even voted for Wallace. And and now she's so progressive that Mr. Nehru is her idol. And I said to her, do you always have to have an idol? She said yes. She has to have an idol. Because he has no philosophy. Mr. Nehru today in this country is such a joke, because there's nobody who hates America more than his delegate here, Mr. Menon. He's a great yes, he is a great leader in this country. He tries to degrade us. And we listen to him because we need something new, something you see. The only philosophy in this country is fashion. Then their latest mental fashion. Because you evade the issue, gentlemen, you have to have a philosophy. Because if not, you have another man's philosophy. Because at any moment you must know whether the trees in Oregon can be cut down or not. As you know, the people in Oregon, Idaho, and Washington had their very appropriate ideas about Hell Canyon and conservation. They are very, very much harder hit than we. They have a philosophy of government there. I have a friend there who worked in the Columbia River power development, and he's in politics. And I know how deeply the people there have, for this limited area at least, a definite philosophy. Very strongly developed, and that's how they defeated Mr. McKay and Mr. Welker. It's a partial philosophy, but it's something to know that people know the difference, gentlemen, between a forest that is alive and between a forest that is a thing. That's ethos, gentlemen. Well, take it now down. Ethos is the treatment of the universe as much alive, at least, as myself, or more. And physis is the treatment of the universe as less alive than myself, or dead. You have a hell of a time to appreciate The Tempest by Shakespeare, because the world there is ethically treated by Ariel and spirits and Caliban, and the whole island, as you know, is alive. And that's for you joke, gentlemen. I doubt that it is a joke. I have, in my long life, coming from a big city with too much laptop in the streets, I had to recover my senses. And I think I have. I now fully understand the necessity of speaking in gender of the La Forêt, as the French do. It isn't a thing for a Frenchman to call it La Forêt, you see. It is alive. And the sea is the same. What is the sea in English? Which is she and which is it? Yeah? How about the sea? Isn't there an English distinction? Yeah? What? Which sea is feminine?
S-E-R.
No, S-E-A, sea.
Yeah,
because that's why I mentioned it to you, gentlemen. Where there is a complete name, there is personality, you see. Atlantic Ocean, she, you see, can be she. And thereby it moves up to the grade, you see, of life. It's your equal. That's a great story. The abstract sea, you see, thing, Newton. It, you see. The named thing, alive. St. Augustine's, I told you this about incest, my famous example, gentlemen. In the old Roman law and in St. Augustine, there's found the explanation why we can't marry our mother and our sister. You think that's something natural. Nothing in nature, gentlemen, that would forbid you to marry your the animals. They do forget who is their mother and their sister, and they do mate. So it is perfectly natural. It has nothing to do with unnatural incest, gentlemen. It has only to do with ethos. And St. Augustine has put it in a nutshell when he said, I cannot make love to my mother and sister because I already at first have received them by another name of love. And therefore, the new power of naming would be impoverished. I could never supplant, as you see, replace one name of love, the first name, mother, you see, by a new name of love which would ring absolutely unheard of. The essence of love is the new name. The very profound, and I think the only profound, justification of incest. It doesn't belong to the biologists. It doesn't belong to the geneticists. It belongs to the ethicists. Ethos is hurt if what you have receives in a tepid move or a lukewarm move, a warm mood, mother or sister, you see, suddenly is obliterated by the explosive force of regard and love. We must not you evade all these serious issues by putting them like genetics and eugenics into the department of zoology. But gentlemen, you and I will never be a zoological being. It's hopeless for you and me, because we are shocked by wrong names. If somebody calls you a liar, you can think 1,000 times that's just a word. It burns you up. Yesterday, Mr. Booth read the Othello, who went there. Oh, you are not freshman any longer, so you are through with Shakespeare. Well, Cassio, you see, is dismissed from his office by Othello, and he runs around and says, I have lost my reputation, reputation, reputation. It's a very wonderful scene, because the Carrasco Iago is already the naturalist and says, oh, the body, if you were wounded, I would pity you. But reputation, it's nothing. Reputation. After all, everybody who landed on these shores usually had already lost his reputation in Europe. So what's the difference? Reputation, makes no difference. But it does, gentlemen. Unfortunately, Mr. Cassio is moved through the whole play by his loss of reputation. And Desdemona perishes because she tries to restore his reputation.
Well, sir, Iago equivocates, though, because later on he says, he who steals my purse steals trash.
Pardon me?
But later on, Iago says, he who steals my purse steals trash, but he who steals my good name is taking something.
Well, Iago, of course, is the devil. The devil is the man who knows the importance of ethics, but refuses to believe it. You see, the real problem of faith, which I have already tried to tell you, I think, at other times, is that people who know something won't believe it. You always think that on the one side of the ledger is faith, and on the other is belief. And so you divide science and religion, and you say, religion is belief that which cannot be known, or which is stupid, or which is the opposite of science, and science is the facts. And that's not the story. The problem of knowing and believing is quite different. Iago says, I know, you see, but he doesn't act on it, and therefore he doesn't believe in it. That's the devil. Believing, it means action, to act on something. I told you the story of Mr. Stephenson, the Arctic explorer who went to Washington in 1942 and said, after Pearl Harbor, I said, you know for 400 years that the earth is round, don't you? And they said, yes, but you have not believed in it. And you don't believe in it. Why don't you? They were very much surprised. You know the story. And what was his answer?
Believe that it meant action.
In which sense?
Or?
Yes, and in which context was it important for our war effort? In flying over the Kuriles, yes, and the illusion, instead of over via Hamas. The road of the equator, obviously, you see, is quite as long as if you go take the shortcut at the periphery of the ball, of the globe. And they had known, but they had believed. The same true is of Iago, sir. And the same is true of you, gentlemen. You know that men should have solidarity, but you don't act it out in Clinton, Tennessee. So this was my duty for your paper, first to state once more that logos, physis, and ethos, gentlemen, are realities, because the city of man speaks to us, but is small. The universe doesn't speak to us, but is big. You can also take down this as another sideline. We always experience space as a whole, and then subdivide it into things, into smaller things. First, you wake up and there's this whole space until you come to an entrance. And then you can subdivide it into seats in this room and places inside. The experience of space is first as one. And every division of Egypt and Arab countries and Africa and Europe is belated, is second. Time is experienced the other way around. You experience first the one moment of your own life, and then perhaps your own life. That all time is one. It has to be created. It has to be believed. It is not natural. It's nonsense to tell you that all time is one. It's not an experience. It's a thought. It's just a creation of the mind, an act of will. Most people never realize it. Most people live as though they were the only people in the world, and their own time was the only time that existed. Now, most people don't know this. You always speak so glibly of space and time. Take it down, gentlemen. Space and to put space and time together in this manner is a mere superstition. It doesn't exist. Because all space is first experienced as singular, as one space, and all spaces are fragments and fractions of this one big space, of the universe. But your lifetime, gentlemen, is first experienced as this time to yourself. You cannot share it with anybody. It's the existential problem. You only have your own time.
You see?
And you have nothing else at first. Given your own time, given the universal space. That's the only, the other two facts. You see? If you can say, however, that your little home is not for sale, because it is yours in this universe. And if you can say that all men of all times, the ages, belong to you and you belong to the ages, then you have done something that is not natural, that's purely ethical. That's the creation of the Logos. The unity of time, gentlemen, and the division of space is the achievement of the Logos. Arbitrating between the space of physics and the time of society. The unity of time, gentlemen, and the divisions of space are the achievements of the Logos, of the words spoken to these times and to this space. To space, we say, make room for a nation, for a little nation too, you see. To time, we say, be one, from the beginning to the end. Because it isn't by nature. We have no experience of any time before your birth and before after your death. It can't be experienced, purely fiction. But the fiction you can believe in. That's the dream castle which we build. Let's have a break here. Gives us a good Anglo-Saxon term for society.
It's not Anglo-Saxon. It's Assyrian. I looked it up too. It comes from Tinan.
I got mine from Webster's Inappropriation.
I got mine from Webster's Academic. 1850.
Well,
There is an Anglo-Saxon word, however, which we saw the other day, bird, B-U-R-D-A.
Okay.
I'm fairly certain that's a Germanic in origin, bird.
Oh yes, it's Berg, Newberg, and what have you, Berger, the word Berger comes from it, you see, the citizen. Of course, that's in German too, I mean, the same, Bürger. And bourgeois is the same, French Bourg, from which bourgeois comes. That's exactly the same word. Berger, it's Dutch too. But that's not the story. The Berg is, after all, the fortified place, but the minimum for a settlement in the old days was a hedge. And in German it is this, and this is pronounced like town, so it could also be spelled this way. And in English, T, in German is always Z. You have the English 2 and we have German 2, you have English 10 and you have German 10, and you have English town and you have German town. And the town is today nothing but a fence. Now the important thing is, gentlemen, that our ancient ancestors were good philosophers. You have lost their insight that men can only exist behind a fence. The fence of the law, the Jews called it, the fence of the law. That is, human society is only able, by some distinction from nature, you see, to begin to exist, to live. And therefore the word town and the word town in English, in German, or the word fence today, the fence of the law, means that people among themselves accredit each other with life and personality and grant each other the right to live. The Human Rights Day was yesterday, and you know the president had to say that it was very poor at this moment how it was handled. But what you call human rights is this living behind a fence where we cannot be treated like nature. You cannot treat a man inside your town, inside your town, you see, inside our town. We have to treat each other as alive as we ourselves, or as I said to you in the definition, more alive. You look up to a judge and a minister or priest or good mother as more alive than yourself, I hope, or to the poet. And therefore, receiving dignity, authority. What is authority? Dignity, recognition that they have more life than we have. We grant them, therefore, recognition of a higher life. It's all very simple, gentlemen. The whole gradation is constantly made by every one of us I have seen young children snub an old man of 85, and I have seen them revere him. And that's then a decision they constantly make. You see, if they treat him as nature boys, then they think because the man has no teeth and no hair left, he's just dead. And they treat him in nature as less alive than they are. If they live in a good society with a fence of the law around them, they'll get up when an old man enters the room or an old lady and will show their reverence. And that's the difference between the fence, outside the fence and inside the fence. And today the assumption of the young brat is that there is no such pale. You, outside the pale, no meaning for you. The juvenile delinquent has totally conquered society. The juvenile delinquent thinks that he's outside the fence, that everything is nature. He can shoot anybody in Central Park. That's nature, you see. This business of town then and township is something rather very simple. Really, the recognition that the whole difference between ethos and nature and physics is in the fence. Everybody inside the fence has a right to live. Nothing outside the fence has this right, you see, can claim it, because it doesn't speak to us. We manipulate it, we treat it, we make war against it, we exploit it. We may take it as a garden into the city and plant the flowers there and treat them, you see, as domesticated animals or domesticated plants. Then they come to life with us. Now let's turn to the, this is the last day today on Plato. Will you kindly look up this symposium? I said to you that the greatness of Plato is in the Republic is that he identifies the individual and the Republic. That all the powers of the Republic as a whole, the organization of mind, heart, and belly, is found as well as in any city as in the individual. That's, and I said we should use the word micropolis for men in Plato. Men in Plato is a little city. And the other is a macropolis. And you see, therefore, that's an ethical concept. Plato has for men and society nothing physical, but to him it's ethos. You speak of microcosmos and macrocosmos and think that's Greek philosophy. You're mistaken. In Plato and Aristotle, men is the city written small. This is very important because I said to you, Plato and all philosophers ever since, gentlemen, are a community inside themselves. Any philosopher must be able to voice inside himself the voices of the whole community. He is not a philosopher who cannot speak the jargon of a king, of a mother, of a worker, of a slave, of a technician, of an inventor inside himself and makes it all harmonize. A philosopher is a small city inside himself, gentlemen. That is, since Plato, the solution. It may not be true that you and you are a little city. You may be just individuals. But a philosopher, you see, one man in the city must be like the city. A little acorn, so to speak, you see, the egg, the seed of the whole city.
It's interesting, Chris, to note that Democritus, according to Aristotle, to D.L., said that a man is a small world.
Well, there you have a kind of derailment. I mean, he should have said he's a small city, I'm sure. That is the break in the tradition. Today we all say small world. That is microcosm. Microcosm, small world. Gentlemen, I warn you. I'll give you an example of how experience is very practical. 40 years ago, I was a soldier in the war, and I was deeply moved, of course, by the conflict, and I tried to fancy, at the front it was, in the second year of the war, possibility of unifying all the veterans of all the different countries and make them turn around and face the home warriors and these journalists and these home patriots and fight them instead, because soldiers at the front are really of the same very much of the same breed as against the ladies at home. And, well, I fumbled around with a project, or literary project, and I had the soldiers and knights and the officers of all nations meet in my imagination. The manuscript is still there, and it's something that has to, probably got to be done about it sometime. And the last speech has this as its content. I offer this to you to make you understand the practical importance of this definition of a philosopher as being a city in the nutshell. They had met regularly and discussed, I mean, the future of the human race, and on All Souls, at the end of the year of the church, in November, you see, the ecclesiastical year goes to an end. Advent already belongs to the next year of the church, you know. November 30th is the last day of the church. Here, I had one man stand all alone. He said, all the others, were 72, seems to have relinquished me, have deserted. I'm here alone. What does this mean? And he said, that's a real triumph, because in this year, we have been welded together to such an extent that everyone can now represent the 71 others too. Everyone has taken over, so to speak, the other nation's viewpoint and the other nation's character to so much that he is now empowered to speak for all. And so we have multiplied out of 72 individuals. I have now come 72 people, you see, who can speak, every one of them, for all 72. Now that is, in a small way, Plato's experience in the Republic, you see. That at least he, Plato, must have filled himself with the positions and the experiences of all men in a city and in all potential cities before he can, you see, propose the best state. Yeah?
In the dinosaur, we can't treat men in any way as natural or objective things.
Well, if you take a tree, sir, obviously, if you have an apple tree, the apple that is able to produce a new apple tree must have a certain width of potentiality. If you begin to treat the human mind as a real thing and not as a flimsy abstraction, you will understand that men can only bear fruit in political thinking if he has really become the apple of the whole tree. That's all I want to say at this moment. I don't want to stress your question so much. If you could only see, I'm moving in quite a different direction from your question. Can you see this? The important thing is that Plato is not thinking in the abstract, but he has filled himself with the life of his city. If you could see this, you see. And so he has become now an acorn or an apple. And the apple tree, Athens, can now wither on the stem and go perish, because through Plato, the Greek free city is safe for generations. You see, from generation to generation, you can read Plato and inherit the glory that was Greece. And also the limitations that were Greece. You can't find in Plato anything beyond the Greek city. The important thing that I wanted to make is you nowhere find in the American tradition the distinction again between nature, according to which the human being would have to be a microcosmos, a small nature, a small world, and the micropolis, the ethical problem that a man must have inherited all the good ways of life of his city, the lawful order, the quality of law abiding, of virtue, you see, before he can speak about government. And you see, there's a very vast discrepancy between being micropolis and being microcosmos. Modern man seems, in this era of chemistry, it's understandable, seems to boast that he is a microcosmos. But then he would have no direction, and he would have not know what is right and wrong, because nature has no direction and nature has no right and wrong. And nature is merciless, as I told you. In nature, everything is just itself. You see, nature is based on selfhood, on impenetrability, on resistance, on gravity, on, you see, on no escape. Society is based on interpenetration, on mutual understanding, on reciprocity, and on inheritance. And I can inherit acquired faculties. And the micropolis, therefore, is Plato. And please say to yourself, all Greek philosophers try to form this micropolis in various degrees. Some thought you could dissolve the polis into physis and Epicurus, and Lucretius. And they try to be microcosmic. There's no doubt that Lucretius and all the Epicureans and Democritus tried to give the weight to physis and said, the city of men is a burden on us. Let's go out into nature. But that's only one strand. Then you get Heraclitus, and you get Socrates, and you get Plato, and they struggle violently, you see, to restore the balance and to say the philosopher must inherit the ways of life of a city before he cannot lay out the next city, before he cannot philosophize.
Well, if the philosopher has all the parts of the city within him, what would be the objection to having the philosopher of the king?
Too muchness. He would take away all freedom from anyone. Nobody could be created. Since he has the nose at all, the others would become automatons. You see? Because he knows too much. I mean, the grain of seed must fall in the ground and die before it can bear fruit, you see. The philosopher is the grain of seed before it has died. You understand? If he rules himself, he can teach. And if then in 72 others, his doctrine comes to life, they can found a city. You see, but Alexander could conquer the world, you see, in the next generation. But Aristotle had no right to rule. That's the difference. The philosopher himself must not rule. Because by his own self, he would extinguish the spontaneous life, the freedom of all the people he ruled. Can't you see this? Overweight. That's the mystery between church and state, gentlemen. The church teaches that it must not rule. As soon as the church rules, you see, it is horrid. It becomes a great inquisitor. Can you see this? It's the same problem, you see. The wisdom of the church has been that it is on a different planet, that it does not rule itself, but it teaches, it instructs, it corrects, it criticizes, it prophesies, it leads, you see, it converts. But the people themselves must act in the state. That's why the separation of state and church is profoundly true. This Plato did not know. Plato is not a Christian. Because he lives before this separation of the gods, you see, and the laws. That's why he's even called a theologian, and he wanted to be king. And you can see that would be a pope who would be emperor, and an emperor would be pope. If you don't understand, that's why Plato at this moment is a great danger to be read. Lenin read him, and the Bolsheviks read him, and you think it's harmless, gentlemen. If you unite Plato's claims in yourself, you become intolerable tyrants. Because your inside is one thing, you see. You can use this for teaching. Or, you see, you're fumbling in the political game, you see, like Mr. Nixon, who is just an opportunist, you see. That's more harmless, because he's just, you see, always out for one thing. He has not a straight thought in his mind, but he can't do much harm. He's not a tyrant. He's not like Lenin or Marx or Stalin. He has no philosophy, you see, except Nixon. It's very strange, but you see, Nixon is only, in Plato's thought, one little side issue. Therefore, he isn't so preponderant. Can you see this? He cannot be so destructive as a man who says, I know it all. Gentlemen, Plato has in the Symposium, in a certain manner, outrun himself. His whole philosophy is between the single philosopher and the city. In the Symposium, however, there's a little more of unity. between people, because the truth comes out in such a way that everyone has to contribute something. There is in this sense no philosopher in the symposium who is alone, but there is an orchestra of philosophers, five people. And that's why it always has been felt that in the symposium, Plato is greater than himself, that he transcends himself in the sense that his love for people and his love of Athens and his love of the arts and his love of love make him, so to speak, explode his own system. And that's a very beautiful spectacle, gentlemen. A living soul must always be greater than its own mind. The love of, you see, of reality must be greater than cleverness. You must be better than yourself. The Bible calls it, let us be more than conquerors. The living soul is always greater than what he knew yesterday to be. I mean, you say, I can't do this, and tomorrow you have done it. Because we live. And life is, the life of the next day must be more than my thoughts of yesterday. And Plato, in a way, I think, has outdone himself in the symposium. And we cannot read it together, but let us look up just a few lines. It is the only place in the Plato in which a woman can say something. And who is she? Diotima, yes. Honored by Zeus is her name. It has been the downfall of Greek philosophy that women were shoved aside, that the experience of married life, for example, was not ever utilized, you see, for explaining any comradeship or community, and that Plato, even in laws and the city, treats marriage as though he was the owner of the stockyards of Chicago. It's butcher. It is sinful. And even demands that in the night of intercourse, a wise woman be present and to judge the eugenics of the case. He's shameless in this respect because he tries to treat love as natural and is unethical, anti-ethical. This is not true of the symposium. In the symposium, the spirit gets hold of a woman, and that's why I think the symposium will always astonish within Greece. Yeah, of course, the Greeks had one very great poetess. Who was she? Sappho. But even this poor woman was condemned to lesbian love by the circumstances. Nevertheless, she was a very, very great woman. I can never read her poetry without being deeply moved. And she holds her own and with any great poet, although we have so very little of her. Every shred of paper we have of her makes her into a first, puts her into the first rank. Will you kindly read 115? Oh, wait a minute. 114, I'm mistaken. Can you? Who has a copy? 114.
Now with your leave, we will take the battle.
Alcibiades, the most beautiful and the most successful statesman of Athens, speaks of Socrates and tries to say what Socrates meant for him. Yeah?
For his fair to pay him his due. When there was that...
That's Socrates. Pay him. Him is Socrates.
When there was that battle after which the generals actually gave me the prize of valor.
So Alcibiades is talking. He was distinguished, but by the order of merit. It's a little bit like the story now of the two swimmers. You have seen the story. One won in the heat with 3 minutes 52 and the other one in the Olympics. Who was it?
Well,
Green.
Jones.
What?
Jones. Green.
Jones was the other name, wasn't it? What's the name?
Rose.
Haven't you read the story?
Rose Green. Green.
No, no, that's
yeah.
not, no.
Yeah.
It's a 400 meter.
You mean
oh, in the rush?
No. It's swimming.
Swimming, yeah.
1500 meters.
Well, didn't you see in Melbourne, he said, I still consider the man who won the heat as a champion. What was it?
That was running.
How do you spell it?
That wasn't swimming.
Crash.
Crash. Really? What's the name?
Jones.
Jones. I know this and the other.
Tom Gordon.
No.
No.
Charlie Jenkins.
Jenkins. That's it. Now we have it. All right. So, Jenkins, you see, gave me the prize of valor. This man. Please, go on. That's Socrates.
When not a single other person came to my rescue and saved my life. I was wounded, but he would not leave me and save my weapons, and me too. Then I make a deal myself, Socrates, to give you the prize for valor.
There you have the Jenkins Jones situation, yeah?
And here you will not find fault with me or say I am lying. But the fact is, when the general looked at my rank and wanted to give me the prize, you were more eager than the general that I should get it and not that I should get it and not yourself. Again, gentlemen, it was worthwhile to see Socrates when the army was routed and retreating from Delios. I happened to be there on horseback and he on foot. This man and Laches were retreating together in the rout. I met them and told them to cheer up, and I said I would not desert them. There, indeed, I had an even better view of Socrates than at Clodotheia. For I had less to fear being on horseback. First I saw how he kept his head much better than Laches. Next I really thought, Aristophanes, to quote your words, that he marched exactly as he does here, with swaggering gait and rolling eyes, quietly looking around at friends and enemies, and making it quite clear to everyone, even a long way off, that if anyone laid a finger on this man, he would defend himself stoutly. And therefore he came off safe, both this man and his companions. For in war, where men are like that, people usually don't touch them with a finger, but pursue those who are running headlong. One could quote many other things in praise of Socrates. Wonderful things.
Would you kindly underline this if you own the book? Wonderful things. You kind of have to dwell on this word wonder right away. Yeah? Go on.
Of his other habits, one might perhaps say much the same about another man, and yet it is not his being like any other man in the world, ancient or modern, that is worthy of all wonder. When men like Achilles...
Men like Achilles might be found. One might take, for example, Brasidas and others, and again men like Pericles, such as Nestor and Antenor, and there are more besides, and so we might go on with our comparisons. But as for this man, so odd, both the man and his talk, none could ever be found to come near him, neither modern nor ancient, unless he is to be compared to no man at all, but to the Silenuses and Sertios to which I have compared him and his talk. For indeed there is something which I left out when I began, that even his talk is very like the opening Silenuses, that's the companion of Bacchus, intoxicated with wine. When you agree to listen to the talk of Socrates, it might seem at first to be nothing but absurdity. Such words and phrases are wrapped outside it like the hide of a boisterous satyr. Pack asses and smiths and shoemakers and tanners are what he talks about, and he seems to be always saying the same things in the same words, so that any ignorant and foolish man would laugh at them. But when they are opened out and you get inside them, you will find his words first full of sense, as no others are, next most divine and containing the finest images of virtue, and reaching farthest, in fact reaching to everything which it profits a man to study who is to become noble and good. Now, will you take over? Go.
This gentleman is my laudation of Socrates, and I have mixed in as well some blame by telling you the way he insulted me. I am not the only one he has treated so. He has done the same to Charmides, Glaucon's son, and Euthyphemus, Diocles' son, and very many others whom he has tricked as a lover and made them treat him as a beloved today.
And made them treat him as beloved instead.
As beloved instead. This is a warning to you, Agathon, not to be deceived by this man. Try to learn from our experience and take care not to be the fool of the proverb, who could only learn by his own. When Alcibiades...
Alcibiades. That's a great pronunciation. Let's stick to that. Alcibiades.
Alcibiades had ended his speech. There was much laughter at his frankness because he seems to be still in love with Socrates. But Socrates said, "You're sober, I think, Alcibiades, or you would never have wrapped all that smart mantle around you with trying to hide why you have said all this, and put your point in a postscript at the end. For your real aim in all you said was to make me and Agathon quarrel. You think I ought to be your lover and love no one else, and Agathon should be..."
Agathon, I think we have to say, I think that's a tradition. Agathon, you have a point. In Greek it would be Agathon. Who knows Greek? So, when the last syllable is long, then the accent has to always in Greek to be on the second syllable. So it would be in Greek, agathon. Should be your beloved and loved by no one else. Yeah? Go on.
"But I see through you. Your satiric and Selenic drama has been shown up. Now, my dearest Agathon, don't let him gain anything by it. Only take care that no one shall make you and me quarrel."
One moment. Gentlemen, Socrates here is shown as the miracle. He himself is a miracle, the wondrous person. I have tried to show you that this is a problem in Greece, that men, the philosopher, is a wonder because he contains the whole city, and therefore the secret of life is the micropolis, you see, is appearing in him and can bear fruit. Then you have the sense of wonder with regard to physis. But in the symposium, there's a third element which you don't have in any other of the dialogues. Admiration. That's the sense, third relation of the miraculous to humanity. Admiration, of course, in your language, has very little to do with miracle. But it is, I'm afraid to say, you see, the same root, and it is the same feeling that you are aroused to admiration because something strikes you as miraculous, or somebody strikes you as miraculous. And so in the symposium, gentlemen, it is the only place where Plato has given a picture of the academy, neither one philosopher, nor the old city, the city of men going to war and planting cabbage and begetting children, that in the academy you have philosophers admiring each other and loving each other and living together in the realm of the spirit. The ethos of Plato appears here, because here is Alcibiades, great scripture, and here, of course, Plato has said, and here is Agathon the tragedian, and here is Aristophanes the writer of poetry, all people of the spirit and of the mind, connected with each other in a feast of love, in a banquet, you see, of a drinking bout and good talk. And that is more than the city and more than the individual philosopher. And in this moment, the academy, which is the unity of spirit, you see, between good men, are united in a selfless company, in a higher service. When Woodrow Wilson came to Dartmouth, gentlemen, unfortunately this speech is forgotten, it's not even printed in his collected speeches. He made a very wonderful speech in 1909. Every one of you should look it up in the addresses of Dartmouth College. It was at the occasion of the inauguration of President Nichols. And Woodrow Wilson gave a wonderful speech and said that a college must be a friendship of an unselfish company. An unselfish company. If it wasn't, it was no good. He also raised the question in this great address, and he said, "While I look around here in Dartmouth Hall," it was, yeah, I think it was Dartmouth Hall, yes, Webster hadn't been there, "I came to think if it was possible that this group here could produce an Abraham Lincoln. And I had sadly to confess to myself that it couldn't. You have again the problem. Philosophers, you see, you can produce in a college. But, you understand? But not Abraham Lincoln so easily. At best, Nelson Rockefeller. Where's my crayon, my chalk? Here. And so I think to end today's, gentlemen, picture of Plato, I've tried to show you that Plato is himself the micropolis. And perhaps I should write him with a couple of M. Because that's a great thing. One man at least has achieved in antiquity that he is the whole city in his own way. There is in him then the logos, that if he can, by his doctrine, reconcile men's existence on this globe, in a city, and enter the domination of the beautiful and the true on this globe, then there is the city. Either Athens, that's the old city, and the future city, that's the Republic, the best city. That is Republic. Now, obviously, gentlemen, that's the ethos of Plato. And we haven't been able to deal much with his physics, but you can believe me that he also has a doctrine about physics. Now, in the symposium, there is a subject. Because the academy, the orchestra, the living together of these philosophers, is not of this world. It's heaven. It's the famous ivory tower of which we talk so much. But I would like you to understand that the ivory tower is not just negative. It's very easy to dismiss the ivory tower. It's a symposium if you read it, and I would like you like to think that some of you will take to it and read it themselves. In the, there is mutual admiration. You call it mutual admiration society, gentlemen. But without admiration, life is intolerable. We have to admire each other. That's not negative. You just have to, in order to stand each other. You don't admire each other, you will kill each other. And therefore, there's a new Plato plus Plato plus Plato. That is a multitude of Platos. Is that heavenly society which ever since has been called the other world. The other world. This is the idea of an other world, gentlemen, which you think is connected with Christianity. It has dynamical spirit. It's a Greek idea. Plato takes refuge in this world of ideas, in this ideal world. As the symposium describes how good people can rejoice in this so-called other world. The wild other. They are not concerned with establishing the best city. They do not step down, so to speak, into reality, you see. But they are released to their own best devices, their own cheerfulness, their own joy in each other. And this mutual love of the symposium is what I try to tell you is the exuberance, the surplus begotten by the philosophizing spirit. Where two, three people can meet in the mind, you see, that is neither logos nor ethos nor physis, you see. That's heaven. There's peace. There is redemption. There is already, at least mentally, achieved the unity of this dilemma. In the symposium, there is no conflict. Everything seems to go easy. It's the Beatitudes, it's the island of the blessed, what the French call les Champs-Élysées. That means Elysium. What all ages have always tried to construct, you see, a heaven in which all these not only dilemmas, but these paradoxes would be dissolved. The symposium is what the seventh letter of Plato says, I have never written down what I really mean to be the kernel of my philosophy, I said. I could answer except in the symposium. The real kernel of his doctrine is that people can already in this world live as the wise can live together, you see, in harmony, despite their differences. There has to be no despotism of one ruling the city, so to speak. And therefore, always when you talk of Plato, put the symposium on quite a different plane from the dialogues or from the Republic. The Republic has to deal with a physical city and an ethical city to be brought down to earth. But the symposium, you're living in heaven. You are living in one good hour, you see, in a festive hour. It's the difference between work day and festive day in the philosopher's life. All the other works of Plato are hard work and something to be learned from it. But the symposium, gentlemen, is not the question of learning anything. Any fool who analyzes the doctrine of love in the symposium deserves to be chased out of the town of the philosophers, you see. Because this is heaven, and in heaven there is no argument. There's just enjoyment in good talk and in friendship and in mutual love. Now, I find many pedants you probably have found in your textbooks, men like Will Durand or some such gentleman. He will, of course, put all these writings on the same plane, you see, and go to work and make mincemeat out of this symposium. But the symposium, gentlemen, is a work of art. And it is a unity between thought and scenery, so to speak. And woe to you if you ever come to deplore, to rape the symposium, gentlemen. That's not a question of argument, but that's a question of joining in. If you can, in your own friendship, establish such an evening with your good friends, then you have made the right use of the symposium.